Tuesday, January 30th, 2018, Masoret. We're discussing certain areas in Shemos. Maybe some of them we've taken up before, but didn't resolve completely, or some may be entirely new. The beginning of Shemos, the description about the factors which led to the enslavement. As usual, the Chumash doesn't give that much information. It's just, certain generalities, generalizations. And before you know it, there's the death of Yosef and his generation. And then there's the fact that the Jews reproduced at a tremendous rate. They became a force. They became a mighty force. And of course, that's a problem. Had that not happened, one would imagine they would have pretty much been ignored, left alone. I think there's a point over there that, and this has happened many times, that there is an innate disposition to dislike the Jews. That doesn't mean that in every situation you're going to have persecution or anti-Semitism, but it's there. And Jews have to be cognizant of that, and to the best of their ability, our ability, to study those situations and circumstances which could either increase anti-Semitism or to decrease it. In other words, it's a question of making it manageable. It's not going to be eradicated, not at this point in time. Yeah, when the world achieves a state of perfection, it's a different story in Mashiach. So the fact of the matter is that when the Jews become a force to be reckoned with, so then they're noticed, and those who dislike them are going to, then you have the factor of distortion. The Jews control this, they control Hollywood, they control the media, they control everything. This is one of the factors that's listed over here, was Uvnei Israel, because it says that after telling us that there were about the 70 people that came down with Yaakov, I imagine that's to show us, to set the stage, that the development of the Jewish people was not a natural phenomenon, because they came down there with 70 people, and they were not in their own land, they were strangers in a foreign land, and nevertheless they developed into a nation. And then it says that Yosef and all of his brothers died, and that entire generation, which basically means, that group of people that were connected to Yosef and his brothers, because they were regarded differently. They were big heroes because of their closeness to Yosef. And then it says that the Bnei Yisrael par vayishritzu, vayirbu, vayatzmu, b'mod mod. And it's talking, there's a lot of different terms over here which indicate a tremendous increase. I have Chazal Rashi that says each woman would have 6 children. Nevertheless, they were... So that's the numera. I don't know if it means... these types of midrashim, I don't know that they're necessarily to be taken literally. And as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't really matter. What is important is the idea. And the idea is that they went through a tremendous period of reproduction. Something very unusual. And it was not only in terms of numerical. Because then there's a question of... I imagine in those days, they didn't have the kind of medical facilities that we have. So... stillborns or children dying in infancy was a major problem. Even in America around the Revolutionary War, it was a major phenomenon. I don't have numbers, but it wasn't like today. I don't know at what point in time it became sort of like removed, that problem became eliminated. But it was a problem throughout history. But here you see the opposite, that not only did they have, I think it's the Malbim that mentions, because if you have many, many children, so that increases the, usually they're not all well. I mean, it's difficult for each one to get its proper nourishment in the womb and so forth. So they're born, premature, not fully developed and things of that sort. But here, in spite of that fact, they were all strong and healthy and, and then they had a tremendous increase, and the land became filled with them. And then the next thing is a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Yosef. So I think that that's a factor that when the Jews become a force, when they're powerful and very successful, so then it's going to breed resentment. Now, when you say something like that, so what are you supposed to do? Not? What were they supposed to do? Not increase? Just lay low and be nobodies? So it's a dilemma. I don't think that that should lead us to the conclusion that the Jews should not strive for success. It's part of the Jewish makeup, generally speaking. I mean, they've been held back throughout history with persecution, but give them the freedom in America and they just burst forth. Because we have this, not just the religious Jews, but it's part of the identity of the Jew to be a person of knowledge and learning, education, even secular Jews. And that's one of the main reasons for the Jewish success, which I tell people, non-Jews as well. It's not that Jews are superior, but you take a group of people that are intelligent people and you instill in them the ideal of learning. Because that's something that all Jews respect. And we never had a culture, it's not like in other groups where it's the athlete, the football player, and things of that sort. Now, of course, as Jews become more assimilated in America, so they take on those kinds of values. But even so, the emphasis is on intellectual development, something that requires use of the mind. So that's a basic drive. That's a big factor. That's a very, very big factor in determining, the Jewish way of life. So it doesn't make sense to say that. It's sort of like a contradiction. You're caught in a paradox. You sit around and do nothing, so you're a failure. You go out and you become successful, so you'll be hated. So what are you supposed to do? I don't think that's the conclusion. We should use... Person has a right to use all of his abilities and in the correct way, hopefully according to the values of the Torah, and to become successful. But I think that's, the values of the Torah kick in at that point. That is, even if we are very, very successful, but if we adhere to the values of the Torah, so then there may be resentment at the success, but when they see how we relate to that success, and how we utilize it, that is, if we're really good citizens and do things for the benefit of the community and we don't flaunt it, which arouses jealousy, because it's a natural thing anyways. I mean, it's a natural thing. It's a big factor in the American culture today, in the political arena. That whole idea of income inequality, and that it's unfair. And there is a culture of hatred of the rich. They call them the 1%. It's there. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that he's a much reviled president, or Trump. That's part of it. I mean, it's not the whole of it, but that's a big thing. And there's this big attraction to people that never could have made it in American politics, like Bernie Sanders. socialist. And that has to do with envy and resentment, which is encouraged by these, you know, politicians on that side. So that factor is there. And thus, but you see, it doesn't always work. In other words, there are very, very wealthy people that do not arouse that kind of a emotion. I mean, billionaires. Take a person like Warren Buffett, or Bill Gates. These are people that are, the word wealthy doesn't describe them. When you're talking about 50 billion and things of that sort, because they're very plain, ordinary, humble people, and they do their best to use their money to help people. So there's nothing to be envious of, because when you imagine a rich person, oh, he could do this, he could do that, in other words, it's the real envy is the envy of the person who is indulging all of his fantasies. That's the envy. That's what they really wish for, because that's what money represents, at least in the mind. In the person's mind, oh, he's got money, he could have all the enjoyments, endless indulgence. So that's what they're really envious of. But they see, when they see the person is doesn't go to his head, doesn't have that ego, and he's very plain. He lives pretty much the same way everybody else lives. And in addition to that, he uses the money to benefit others. Then it does not lead to envy. So to the contrary, it leads to a tremendous respect. Because there's a person that could do whatever he wants to do with his money, and he doesn't do those things. I think he's a very good example of that, Warren Buffett. I can't imagine anyone disliking him or hating him or being envious of him. He doesn't evoke that kind of a response. So I think that would be a good guideline. So the Jews, I mean, that's part of our philosophy in terms of the importance of wealth and the purpose of life and how you should live your life, and of course the value of helping other people and so on and so forth. So that if the Jews were to do that, and they would not allow the wealth to go to their head, and they would be humble and friendly and helpful, then I think it would reduce. You'd have a lot of friends. I mean, you always have kooks. There's no question about it. I'm not saying you get... There are some people where it's just intrinsic. They hate Jews, period. But they would be like the minority, I believe. Anyways, I think that's one of the... I don't know. See, it doesn't really give you much more information. It gives you these pieces of the puzzle. Okay, so they became powerful and so on and so forth. Then there arose, and we don't really know why. We don't really know why this new king, whether it's the same, like Rashi says, it was the old king and he took on a whole new attitude, or whether it's a completely new king. I don't know that it makes that much difference, but that question is not really addressed. Okay, well, what caused him? What caused them to adopt this attitude that the Jews were a tremendous danger, a fifth column? Any thoughts? I agree that people who are successful, and you're adding the fact that they are they're numerous and they have different customs. That is true. That's innate. They couldn't eat together with the Jews, because the Jews were shepherds, and you know, their whole religious system and their deities were sheep or cow, whatever. They worshipped those objects. So that innately creates a certain dislike. But they were able to accept the Jews for quite a while. So what happens now? What changes it? What is it that triggers the anti-Semitism? And the anti-Semitism is basically this distortion of reality that the Jews are a fifth column. Okay, so they experience this growth. Is that what it is? Or is there a... Because that's the question I'm raising. So anytime the Jews multiply and become successful, that's automatically going to create anti-Semitism? Or is there another component of how we treat it, how we relate to it? And that's what I was raising. Doesn't really... Because all we know is that a new king arose. I mean, that's meant to tell us that... That... You see, Yosef had created something. The fact that Yosef was the man who saved Egypt, that had a tremendous impact. So he was and he was like number two to Paro. So he was the most respected person. So that already had an effect upon how he was treated and how his family was brought in. But it was just a family. It was a family that was brought in, and they were extremely respected. Take a look at how these very same people are the ones who showed such tremendous kavod, honor to Yaakov when he died, and accompanied. That's a big thing. The amount of days and mourning, and then they sent the biggest dignitaries on this trek to Canaan. It's not an easy trip today. Can you imagine in those days to participate in the burial of Yaakov? So it doesn't get much greater than that in terms of respect. And now we find that they are enslaving the descendants. Okay, so I hear your point that it's one thing when it's basically a small group. It's a small group of people. But now we're talking about a small group of people that had transformed themselves into a significant force. But is that all? So that's it? Now they become a threat? Now, it's necessary to tell us about the new king, which means that however you want to take it practically, I think the plain shot, in my opinion, is that it's a new king. I think the Midrash is an idea. That is, I don't think in the Midrash, the one who, could be wrong, but the one who says it was the old king who renewed his decrees. See, that's an interesting discussion in terms of how to utilize a Midrash. Because what's the basis for saying that? You know, if you're not going to go according to the plain meaning, the plain pshat, and you're going to introduce something allegorical or midrashic, but it's not midrashic, and you're going to say, no, this is really the pshat, but it's kind of far-fetched. As pshat, it's far-fetched. So then you have to have good reasons. You have to show why it cannot be taken literally. And that could be the case, if you can make a strong case and show why it makes no sense to take it literally, and then you have an alternative understanding which makes really, really good sense, so then fine. But why would you go away from the plain shot, where it says that Vayakam Elachadash Al Mitzrayim, a new king arose over Egypt, who did not know Yosef? I mean, it's a stretch to say that it's the old king, then it's not a new king who arose over Egypt. That pshat is pretty far removed from the actual words. So then a person has a right to say, what do you mean? Say whatever you want if that's the case. So therefore on that, I could be wrong, but my interpretation is that there's no real argument. The plain shot is that we're talking about a new king. So why does the other one, I don't think it says, it's Rav and Shmuel. I don't know if it identifies which one says what. It doesn't matter. Is that, because Rashi says, Chad Omar, Chadosh Mamish, one says, actually new, V'chad Omar Shen is Chad Shugzei Rosov. And one says, no, Chadosh, the term new, refers to his decrees. All right, so he doesn't say which says which. And it doesn't matter. But what do you mean? What prompted him to say that? Okay. Now in the Sifsei Chachamim, he has a note on that, and he says the Yimlo King. Because if you don't say that, then as if you don't say that, it's the old king who renewed his decrees. Vayakam. Why does it say Vayakam? There arose Vayimloch Mibayalei. It should have said Vayimloch. I don't know why. I don't really get that. Vayakam means arose. Vayimloch means ruled. So he wants to say that the term Vayakam implies a change in policy. Again, I don't think that is really his interpretation. I believe that he also agreed that from a factual standpoint, there was a new king. But he's teaching us a profound idea. That is, that it makes perfect logical sense. I could explain it to you, and there's a profound teaching that it could really just as easily be the old king if you understand. All right, Jake gives here on that. If you understand the depth of the psychology, if you go back to the story of the relationship between Paro and Yosef, then you can understand the impact. What are the forces at work that would cause him, the very same person, to turn against his descendants? But I take that as being of tremendous value in terms of the ideas, but that doesn't make it the actual pshat. Okay, so there is a bit of a gap here in terms of understanding the cause as to why, in spite of the fact that they grew, and became a factor and a force, they aroused the fear. That's all I'm saying. Is there anything else that's relevant over here? I mean, it could be, and this is purely speculative, that the Jews at that point in time were not cognizant of what we are talking about. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No. What do you mean?
In other words, at the time that this is happening, the Jews are not cognizant of the fact that there is such a thing as anti-Semitism. There are innate factors, forces over there, and that once they become successful, there's going to be a tendency to become envious and fearful and so forth, and therefore there's a need to behave appropriately to prevent that from happening. See, it does mention the fact that they're Bayamas, Yosef, and the brothers, and that whole generation. Now we have to understand that. Perhaps that is conveying information to us. That too is a factor. Because what does one thing have to do with the other? The fact that they died and so on. All this seems to be a series of ideas that lead to the conclusion of what Paro did, that Paro treated them as an enemy. So perhaps that's what it's telling us, that had Yosef and the brothers and that generation been around, then they would have had the kind of leadership that would have been aware of these types of things and would have been able to control it. See, in other words, you can't blame people all the time because the people aren't cognizant of this. I mean, even today, I mean, Jews that don't really study Jewish history and so on and so forth, so they live in a community and they have this natural desire to become successful and grow, and they just go about it, and they're like an ordinary American, so they'll get this fancy car. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's not in line with the whole philosophy, but I'm saying they're not doing anything wrong. Any other millionaire is doing it, and they'll be buying a beautiful house and this and that, and then having a great time. They're not cognizant of the fact that they're creating problems. I've been in touch, with people that are kind of wealthy, you know, Jews that have made it big, really big. And I always counsel them to keep it to yourself. I mean, to a certain extent, people generally in the community are aware, but they're not aware of the extent. Just be plain, keep it to yourself, because it's not going to get you anything. if people discover, let's say one of you guys should win the lottery and you're like multi-millionaires, okay? Now, of course, everybody wants to exult in his, because it's very joyful and you want people to know and all of that. But it won't be good for you. Well, I don't know if the whole thing was good for a person to come into crazy amounts of money, because that's something that you read the, you know, the stories about the lottery winners. It's in most of the cases it destroys them. It ruins their lives, and then subsequently they wish they never had won it. So it's not such a simple thing. But with as far as other people are concerned, you're going to have two kinds of people. You're going to have people will come out of the woodwork. There are those who feel that there's something in it for them. They're going to want something, whether because they're in the family or because they're friends or some connection, and believe me, every charity in the universe. So you are a target. And then there's the other people who can't get anything out of it, so they're just going to hate you because they're going to be envious. So what's the good? When you think about it, what is the good of having people know that you have an enormous amount of money? What is the good of that? Now, it sounds crazy because for most people, that's the whole thing. They want everybody to know. That's that ego gratification. They want to be admired. They want people to look at, wow, you know, and they look at you in a certain way. I've seen that because I've been around wealthy people. And I see how others look at them. Like there's a certain awe. Like these are, you know, super people, supermen. But the point of it is, there's no benefit. There's only negative. You're better off that no one, no, whatever. As I said, you may not be able, people know that you're not poor, but they don't have to know the full extent. And of course, hopefully you'll use, that's a separate parsha. You know what it means to you and how you use it. That's something else, of course. But I'm just saying, it's not a good idea, if possible, for to let people know if you have a lot of money. So, but I'm just saying that I was giving an example of someone who's going about things in the natural. He doesn't know this. He doesn't think about this. He thinks it's a good thing. He wants to become successful. So he doesn't realize. He doesn't realize you have this phenomenon in America, you know, the 1%, the envy of the rich. So that he's not aware that if he should become very successful, he really has to think about it very, very carefully, how he's going to present himself, what kind of a posture he's going to assume. So I'm saying it's possible that the Jews themselves weren't really that cognizant at that point in time. And they didn't have the leaders who were able to direct them in terms of how they should behave. Because that is a problem. That is to say, what we see from this is that the fact that they went through this tremendous development, which is a really, really good thing, and they became a force to the point where they were going to assume the status of being an independent nation, that this is a problem. And this is definitely going to arouse envy, and it's definitely going to arouse hatred. Perhaps that is the explanation that they didn't curtail. They didn't engage in the appropriate types of behaviors, which would have, perhaps, which would have prevented this from happening. That's what, maybe that's why the pasuk includes the absence of these leaders. Under the leadership of Yosef, Yosef, you know, genius in terms of his understanding of human nature and so forth, and the rest of that group, perhaps it would have had a different effect. So then it says that a new king, and to me that just means someone who wasn't bound, who wasn't intimidated by the past, he had freed himself from the ideas and attitudes of the past, which was basically a pro-Jewish attitude. And that Hashaloh Yodas Yosef. I mean, Yosef didn't mean anything to him. And then it says, Vayomer Lamo, He said to his people, Hine am b'nei Yisrael, ra vi'atzo mimenu. Behold, the nation of b'nei Yisrael are more numerous and stronger than us. Okay, let's just stop on that. What's difficult about this pasuk? Basic question on this pasuk is that really true? Doesn't seem to be true that's the case. I mean, yeah, the Egyptians were a mighty nation. So even if the Jews have increased, I mean, even when they left, I mean, how many were there? What was it, 600,000 men? And then you had children, women, 1.5 million total or two? I mean, they couldn't have been as numerous as the Egyptians at that point in time. And they couldn't have been stronger than them. Wouldn't make sense. And if they were, then why would they start up with them? Then the Jews should have dominated them. That pasuk from the Malbim, they have an English edition, which is the essential Malbim. Because it's sort of like condenses, makes it easier to go through. I mean, that shouldn't stop you from going through the full text in Hebrew, but, you know, just to get to the main point without having to go through all of the description. So I'm reading on this. After the above introduction, he says the Torah begins to describe Paro's wicked plot against the Jewish people and the actual evils he carried out against them. The primary focus of this part of the narrative is to reveal just how profoundly evil Paro and the Egyptians were. In order to justify all the divine retribution and the plagues that Hashem brought upon them, and to deflect the question that many people have asked, namely, was it not decreed upon the Jewish people that they suffer affliction and slavery? Were not the Egyptians merely Hashem's agents, therefore, to carry out this decree? If so, why were the Egyptians punished so severely for this? Okay, that's a good question. Let's put that on on the side for the time being. That's a question that the Ramban takes up, and the Rambam takes up. The Rambam takes it up in the section where he deals with free will. And versus predestination. That's an interesting question. But we're not taking it up right now, but I think put it on your list. All these questions that we raise are good now, and they're also going to be very useful at the Seder. That is that if this seems to have been decreed, you know, by the Bris Bein HaBsarim, when God told Abraham that his children would be strangers in a land that was not theirs, and they would afflict them, and so on and so forth, if obviously it's a reference to this. So the question being, if this was already decreed, then why were the Egyptians liable? Why were they punished? So the Rambam gives his answer, and the Ramban has a different answer, which is worth taking up, but not right now. I'm going to proceed now, quoting from the Malbim. To answer these questions, the Torah describes clearly how the Egyptians were well-deserving of their punishment as follows. Well, you see, this seems to be in line with the Ramban's. The Ramban's approach is different than the Rambam's. He seems to be of the opinion that if the Egyptians were carrying out the will of God, then they shouldn't be punished for that. But what he's saying is they just went about it too ambitiously. They were excessive, and they inflicted excessive harm, way and beyond what God had decreed for them. That's basically the pshat of the Ramban. As I said, it's worth going through it because I have questions on the Ramban. Even so. But the Malbim, I'm just pointing out, the Malbim seems to be saying the same thing, that the Torah here is pointing out the extreme evil of the Egyptians in order to justify the fact that God punished them. So he says, quote, the nation of the children of Israel is greater and mightier than we are. And here's the point that I wanted to get to. If, as Paro seems to say, the Jewish people already outnumbered the Egyptians, how could Paro then proceed to propose a plot against them, quote, lest they increase? Hadn't they already increased? Okay, so he's, I think that's basically, I mean, he adds an element to our question. Our question was that it doesn't make sense to say that the Jews are outnumbered and were more powerful than the Egyptians. First of all, it doesn't seem that they were, that they could, at that point in time, they had such numbers, A. And B, if they were more powerful, then why would they undertake to dominate the Jews? The Jews who were more powerful would just beat them or destroy them or whatever. The whole thing doesn't seem to make sense. But then, in the next pasuk, he adds this dimension. He says, Havan is chakmalo. Let's deal wisely with him, lest he increase. And it will be, this is not such an easy pasuk. Lest he increase. And it'll be when there's a war, if war should occur, v'nosaf gam hu al sonenu, and he'll join forces with our enemies, v'nilcham banu, and fight against us, v'olam min ha'aretz, and go up from the land. All right, so this is what I really wanted to focus on, the last words, and go up from the land. But before we get to that, this pasuk also adds to the first question. That is, because the first pasuk seems to be saying that the Jews are more powerful than we are. Okay. Which seems very difficult to believe. In the next pasuk it says, lest he increase. But what do you mean, lest he increase? According to the first pasuk, he's already done the increasing. He's more numerous and powerful than you are. So how do you resolve that? Again, I think that it means they're going to become. That is to say, a lot of times you speak that way. When you're getting worried and a possible foe is beginning to expand and grow, so you, and you're worried about it, you kind of describe it in terms of your fear. They're more powerful than we are. Even though at this factually it's not exactly true, but that's the fear. The fear is. In other words, his point is that they're going to be. They're going through this unusual type of development, and I could see where it's headed. That's what he's saying. I could see where it's headed. And left alone...
Rabbi?
Yes.
I mean, this isn't so different from what you're saying, but could it also be not that he sees where it's headed, but that this is just an indication of his psychological state and how he views them? That yeah. He sees them as more powerful than they actually are at that point?
Well, yeah, you're saying a good thing, and there's absolutely no contradiction, because there's two sides. The other question is, what's causing him to say this? You do seem, it's his fear, or he's projecting. I think there's a lot of very fundamental psychological concepts at work over here. That is to say, you're right. It adds to it. And this is true throughout history, that most of the, or all of the, real anti-Semitism, the charges that were leveled against the Jews, are really projections. That's how they would behave. That is, in point of fact, the Jews have always been loyal. And the Jews at this time had no interest in rebelling. That's what's so funny about it. It's the most insane thing. I mean, anti-Semitism is a form of insanity. It's a form of insanity. Because even today, the kind of things that they say about the Jews, the reasons that are given for the hatred of Israel, the hatred of the Jews, have no bearing at all. It's not rooted in anything. It's sheer insanity. You take a look at the charges they make about the Jews and what they did to the countries and where do you see that? The Jews are not criminals, probably the lowest in terms of any kind of crime rate. I'm not, essentially, I mean, I'm talking about violent, you know, theft and or attacking people, things of that sort. You don't find that. I mean, ask any policeman which neighborhood he would prefer to patrol in. Borough Park, the five towns. He doesn't have to worry about... gunfights breaking out in the middle of the night. you know, Jewish kids driving by with guns and so forth. And in any other area, they've brought tremendous benefit to every country they've been in. So it's clearly a mental disease. And we have to emphasize that more and more these days because it hasn't gone away. I mean, the kind of things they say about Israel, and it's just the opposite. Israel, to a crazy extreme, they provide help and benefit and treatment to their worst enemies. They're the first when there's an earthquake somewhere. And the only ones that are, it's amazing how nobody, and it's not just the Arabs that won't acknowledge, it's just in America too. There's a tremendous, on the campuses, there's a tremendous amount of hatred that is manifested. And we'll look at the facts. So if it's so contrary to the facts, then it has to be a psychological explanation. There must be a psychological explanation. So the two points are correct. Because what I'm saying is that the words that he used, he didn't mean it literally. It's an expression of his fear. It's an expression of his view of how things are going to turn out. But what caused him to believe that was his own psychological disposition, the paranoia. He's projecting something onto the Jews. Well, that comes out in the next pasuk. Nanny, that's why he says pen yirba. In other words, first he expresses the fear, and he expresses it as though it's already in existence. That's how, you know, it's already there, stronger than us. Then, in the next pasuk, he's getting down to the practical, what we have to do. Then he says, "Pen yirba." That left untouched, this is what it's going to come to. So, pen yirba. We have now. What am I afraid of? What's my picture? My picture is that if we just let things go the way they are, then they will increase, lest they increase. And then there's another thing, a war will come along. And he will join with our enemies and turn against us and go up from the land. Was there any fact? Was there any basis for this? I mean, this is a serious thing. A king is going to enact a policy. It's based upon some kind of thinking. And nobody gets up and says, well, one second, do you have any evidence? Is there anything we can point to that would substantiate this? What have they done? So you see, I mean, it's a good point that you must factor this in. You see, it's becoming clearer now that we've discussed it. You must factor it in. That all instances, I'm seeing now, on the other hand, I was saying that there are certain behaviors of the Jew which constrain. I agree with that. I agree. I don't know whether that would have made a difference in this case or not. I really don't know. But, and you know, I don't know if any change in Jewish behavior would have affected Hitler. It would not have. Because his insanity was so deeply rooted that you couldn't talk to him. And it's an amazing thing that he got an entire nation to go along with him on that. All right, not every single German had the same attitude towards the Jews, but there was enough of them that did or were sympathetic or went along. The hatred of the Jew is so powerful. But then anybody at any point in time, because he came onto the scene, I don't know, in 1920, around that, that's when he first started to do his career as a politician. I don't know if there was anyone anywhere along the line that sat down with him and said, well, you know, your attitude towards the Jews, what's it? It was just accepted. I mean, and he projected onto them the worst possible defects. I mean, it wasn't even a matter of Jewish behavior. It had nothing to do with, and even if a Jew that converted to Christianity, it had nothing to do with anything except the fact that he's Jewish in his blood, he's going to infect. These are the most insane ideas. And yet, an entire nation. And it's an advanced nation. Now, Germany was an advanced nation and an educated nation. That's a scary kind of thing. All the education in the world, if you unleash a powerful emotion, and apparently this is the most powerful emotion, that latent anti-Semitism, you've got to appreciate how powerful that is. Jews have to appreciate how powerful that is. And it has not been eradicated with, you know, the German defeat in World War II. It's really made a tremendous comeback. Now, of course, the prime movers are the Islamic. But it's not just that, because if you go to campuses, on the campuses, in many of these campuses, you can't have a speaker that's going to be pro-Israel come on the campus. I mean, he's going to have to, it's not just that, it's any basically anyone who's conservative. They have to hire special security and all of that. But definitely, if it's the sympathies have now shifted to the poor Palestinians. Israel's the occupier, and so on and so forth. The same lies and distortions that have been around, you know, throughout history. So you can't eliminate that from, we see it here. I mean, this is the first instance, you see it in Paro. Without the slightest piece of any kind of evidence that the Jews constituted a threat, he sets into motion an entire plan as to, we don't know what. That's the next question I want to take up. Yes.
What was the threat of, and I understand joining in with enemies and fighting against them, but what's the Allah min ha'aretz? What's the concern there?
That is exactly what I want to take up. What is the fear? You know, the Rashi, is he referring that we'll go up from the land, or is he referring that the Jews will go up from the land? That is the question that I want to take up and see if we can resolve it or get a clearer understanding of it. So please, if you want to prepare for tomorrow, of course, Rashi, and do some other mafarsh. Do this forno. Because we need to understand that, and we need to understand the subsequent steps that he took. Because he wasn't successful at first. He tried to place this lead they built, Pithom and Ramses, and so on and so forth. Like, what's going on over here? What exactly was his fear? However distorted it was, but how did it manifest itself? And exactly what does it mean, the Olam and Aret? Who is going to leave the land? Was the fear that they're going to join? It's also strange that it all depends upon an enemy. So if there's no enemy, we're okay. Nothing will happen. But if there's an enemy and there's a war, so then they'll join with the enemy. And then someone will leave the land. What does that mean? Yeah, I want to go through it. I don't think we ever really nailed it down. But as I...